Hello, everyone. My name is Raj Gandhi. I'm at Massachusetts General Hospital and Harvard Medical School. And today I'm going to be talking about HIV-associated opportunistic infections. This is the third part of a series. The other two will be given live. And I'd like to thank Dr. Henry Meserve for some of the slides that you'll see today. They have no relevant disclosures. So start off by talking about mucocutaneous infections. We'll cover Candida, varicella zoster virus, herpes simplex virus, and some EBV-associated conditions. Next, we'll talk about some other fungal infections that have not previously been covered. Third, we'll talk about some of the gastrointestinal complications of HIV. And finally, we'll finish off by talking about cytomegalovirus, or CMV. So let's start with mucocutaneous candidiasis in people with HIV. Oropharyngeal and esophageal candidiasis are quite common in people with HIV who have a CD4 cell count of less than 200. In fact, oropharyngeal candidiasis can occur even in people with CD4 counts between 200 and 250, and particularly if they have a CD4 percentage of less than 14%. Esophageal candidiasis, by contrast, typically occurs at lower CD4 cell counts than oropharyngeal candidiasis. The vast majority of mucocutaneous candidiasis in people with HIV is due to Candida albicans, and it's important to recognize that invasive candidiasis is not HIV-related. In fact, Candida in the bloodstream should raise suspicion for catheter-related bloodstream infection or complications of injection drug use. Here are three of the typical manifestations of oropharyngeal candidiasis. On the left-hand side of the screen is what is sometimes called pseudomembranous oropharyngeal candidiasis. What this consists of is these whitish plaques, sometimes on the posterior oropharynx, sometimes on the tongue, sometimes on the buccal mucosa. Importantly, with pseudomembranous candidiasis, the plaques will scrape off with the tongue blade. And it's always important when you're seeing what you think is candidiasis to take out a tongue blade and see if those plaques will scrape off, because if they don't, you may be dealing with something other than candidiasis. In the middle is erythematous candidiasis. You can see the pronounced erythema in the posterior oropharynx. People often can also complain of pain and a bad taste in their mouth. So that's a second manifestation. And then on the far right of the screen is what's called angular chelosis or angular chelitis. You can see these fissures at the corners of the mouth, and that can be due to Candida albicans. The last of these, angular chelosis, sometimes is treated quite effectively with just some topical antifungals to the corners of the mouth. So three manifestations of oropharyngeal candidiasis to really fix in your mind. You'll see these clinically, and you may see one or more of these on the examination. Here's an image of an endoscopy, upper endoscopy, showing you the whitish plaques in the esophagus. This is esophageal candidiasis. And again, this is a very typical picture of candida that goes down into the mid and sometimes lower esophagus. The management of mucocutaneous candidiasis depends on the site of infection, but it's important to start out by saying that fluconazole primary prophylaxis or chronic suppression in people with HIV is not recommended. And this is because Candida, when we used to not have effective antiretroviral therapy, Candida could become resistant to fluconazole. Now, in the modern era, when we have retroviral therapy, it's quite rare for Candida to be resistant to fluconazole, but one of the many reasons to avoid primary prophylaxis or chronic suppression is that first, it's not needed with the advent of antiretroviral therapy, and secondly, there is this residual concern around resistance. Treatment really consists of, for oral candidiasis, oral fluconazole. A dose of 100 milligrams daily is typically recommended except during pregnancy. But if you don't use systemic fluconazole, you can also use topical miconazole, clotrimazole croches, or even nystatin swish and swallow. Now, if a person has esophageal candidiasis, you should not be using topical therapy. That's when you're going to be needing to use fluconazole, systemic therapy, typically given for 14 to 21 days. Now, one of the tip-offs for esophageal candidiasis is that people will complain of odynephagia or pain on swallowing, and they may even complain of retrosternal pain. So if you see someone with advanced HIV who has retrosternal pain or pain on swallowing, odynephagia, think about the possibility of esophageal candidiasis. Typically, the way you'll approach that is by giving them a course of oral fluconazole to see if the symptoms resolve. And if they do not, then endoscopy is indicated to look for other causes of odynephagia. A second mucocutaneous manifestation that I want to highlight here are aphthous ulcers. You can see the aphthous ulcers on the left-hand side of the screen, kind of a punched-out ulcer, sometimes quite painful. And in the right-hand side of the screen, you're seeing the black arrow pointing to a large aphthous ulcer on this patient's lip. So this is a second manifestation of advanced HIV, is aphthous ulceration. Now let's return for a moment to causes of odynephagia in people with advanced HIV. We already said a word about esophageal candidiasis. Again, you're going to distinguish this by giving an empiric course of oral fluconazole. But if someone does not have a response, the important thing then to do is to look for an alternative cause of odynephagia, and this is done through endoscopy. The second potential cause are giant aphthous ulcers, the type that I showed you in the mouth can actually extend down into the esophagus. And then two viral causes of esophagitis should be considered. HSV, herpes simplex virus, can cause an esophagitis, and cytomegalovirus can cause an esophagitis. And those would be alternatives that one would diagnose through endoscopy and obviously would treat very differently than the first two on this list. So now let's shift gears from Candida over to another, in this case, cutaneous manifestation of HIV, which is herpes zoster. So in people who are not yet on antiretroviral therapy or in the period before we had effective antiretroviral therapy, the incidence of herpes zoster was 15-fold higher in people with HIV than in the general population. Now, in someone who's on antiretroviral therapy, there is still an increased risk even on suppressive ART, but this is substantially lowered by the immune reconstitution. Now, localized or so-called dermatomal herpes zoster may occur at all CD4 cell counts. It is more frequent when the CD4 cell count is less than 200 or the HIV RNA is not suppressed, but you can get herpes zoster even in people with higher CD4 counts with virologic suppression. One interesting and important thing to remember is that the risk of zoster appears to be increased in the several months after ART initiation. So someone who has HIV, who starts on antiretroviral therapy, may actually develop herpes zoster, not because they have some kind of immunologic defect, but perhaps because of an immune reconstitution inflammatory syndrome related mechanism. So don't be alarmed if a patient that you start on antiretroviral therapy develops zoster. It's not necessarily because something is going wrong. It may indeed reflect IRIS, which we talked about in a previous lecture. Here are some examples of localized and disseminated zoster. On the top left is dermatomal zoster, the classic grouped vesicles in a dermatomal distribution. And the upper right is a patient with herpes sinus zoster. This is a pain in a dermatomal distribution without the typical rash. On the bottom left, there's a picture of disseminated zoster in a person with advanced HIV, but this cannot be distinguished from primary varicella. Again, these grouped vesicles are not following a dermatomal distribution. And then the last manifestation is ophthalmic zoster, and we'll spend a few minutes on that. But on the bottom right, you're seeing a person with ophthalmic zoster. So let's talk a little bit about that complication. A zoster ophthalmicus refers to reactivation of the VZV virus, the varicella zoster virus, in the ophthalmic branch of cranial nerve 5. You can see that the dermatome outlined here on your left, and you can see a patient with zoster ophthalmicus on the right-hand side of the screen with the group vesicles following the dermatomal distribution of the ophthalmic branch of cranial nerve 5. One important sign to keep in mind is something called Hutchinson's sign, which can be a precursor to VZV eye disease. This particular sign reflects reactivation in the nasociliary nerve of the ophthalmic branch of cranial nerve 5. The tip-off here is vesicles on the tip of the nose or vesicles on the side of the nose. You're seeing an example on the top left-hand side. And the important thing to remember about this particular sign is that it can presage or accompany the development of ocular manifestations. So on the top right is a person with a zoster VZV eye disease, zoster ophthalmicus. On the bottom left is one of the feared complications of VZV eye disease, which is keratitis, corneal inflammation. And you can also get an anterior uveitis or even a retinitis due to VZV. So remember Hutchinson's sign as a precursor to VZV eye disease, vesicles on the tip of the nose or vesicles on the side of the nose. One other manifestation or complication of zoster ophthalmicus is stroke. This is due to vascular inflammation and occlusion. What you're seeing on the bottom right-hand side of the screen where the arrow is vascular inflammation and occlusion of one of the cerebral vessels. This stroke syndrome can occur days or months post-zoster. In one study, the median was about 4 months after zoster when people presented with a stroke-like syndrome. Cutaneous lesions may be absent in about a third of individuals. The other two-thirds will have the typical zoster ophthalmicus skin lesions, but a third will not. And the diagnosis of zoster ophthalmicus-related stroke is by detecting VZV virus, the varicella zoster virus, by PCR in the cerebrospinal fluid, or by finding evidence of intrathecal production of VZV antibody in the cerebrospinal fluid. So either of those diagnostic tests will be a tip-off for zoster ophthalmicus related stroke. Ramsey-Hunt syndrome, sometimes called herpes zoster oticus, is due to reactivation from the geniculate ganglion of cranial nerve 7 now. People present with ear pain. They can have a vesicular rash on the external ear. They can have a lower motor neuron paralysis of the facial nerve. Again, a lower motor neuron paralysis of the facial nerve. If you examine taste sensation, they'll have loss of taste sensation over the anterior two-thirds of the tongue, and they may have cranial nerve 8 palsies, and patients can also present with hearing loss, tinnitus, and vertigo. So these are all manifestations of the Ramsey-Hunt syndrome, also known as herpes zoster oticus. A word about prevention of zoster. I remember now that we have the recombinant VZV glycoprotein E adjuvanted with ASO1B, the RZV recombinant zoster virus Shingrix vaccine. So this is the only vaccine now available in the United States is the recombinant RZV Shingrix vaccine. It's recommended in the general population in people over the age of 50, but in adults with HIV, it's recommended in those over the age of 18, regardless of CD4 cell count. It's a two-dose series. The first dose is at month zero, and then you should give a second dose at somewhere between 2 to 6 months. And don't give the RZV vaccine, the Shingrix vaccine, during an acute episode of herpes zoster. People will have had a boost in their immunity, so you can give it some time later, not preferred to be given during an acute episode of herpes zoster. Let's shift gears now away from zoster and over to herpes simplex. The most common manifestation of herpes simplex type 1 infection is orolabial herpes, sometimes called cold sore. So orolabial herpes is most commonly due to herpes simplex virus type 1. Genital herpes is typically caused by HSV2, but increasingly is due to HSV1. Recurrences and viral shedding are less often with genital HSV1 than they are with genital HSV2. In addition, in men who have sex with men, people may present with proctitis, pain on defecation, other signs and symptoms of proctitis, and some individuals may not have external anal ulcers. Dissemination of HSV is quite rare, even in severely immunosuppressed people with HIV. A couple of other manifestations in people with HIV who have low CD4 cell counts, and what I mean by that are CD4 cell counts of less than 100. We already briefly mentioned esophagitis, but let's reiterate it here. HSV can cause esophagitis, presenting with odynophagia, retrosternal chest pain. Another manifestation of HSV is retinitis. People can develop acute retinal necrosis. And the final manifestation that I want to spend a moment on is what are called chronic, extensive, deep genital ulcers in people with advanced HIV. And importantly, these are often acyclovir resistant. So here's a picture of localized herpes simplex virus, the group vesicles on the erythematous face, fairly typical of localized HSV. And here's a picture of a person with chronic extensive perirectal HSV and a person with HIV who has a low CD4 cell count. Now, this is where you're going to want to look for acyclovir resistance. And the way to do that is to do a viral culture of this perirectal ulcer, do a viral culture, and do phenotypic testing for acyclovir resistance. If you find evidence of acyclovir resistance, the treatment for acyclovir resistant HSV is intravenous foscarnet. So remember, chronic extensive perirectal HSV in a person with HIV and low CD4 cell count, think about HSV, think about acyclovir resistant HSV, and do the viral culture and the phenotypic testing. Now let's move on away from HSV and over to Epstein-Barr virus or EBV. I'm showing you some pictures of oral hairy leukoplakia. You're seeing these whitish plaques on the side of the tongue in several different photographs. An important distinction between where we started, which was candidiasis, is that the whitish plaques in oral hair leukoplakia will not scrape off with the tongue blade. So another reason to have that tongue blade handy when you're looking at someone's mouth with advanced HSV. If you see these whitish plaques and they do not scrape off with the tongue blade, think about oral hairy leukoplakia. This is an EBV-associated condition. Here's an even more dramatic example of oral hairy leukoplakia with those whitish plaques along the side of the tongue. So HIV diseases associated with EBV and people with HIV include oral hairy leukoplakia, And they also include primary CNS lymphoma. Primary CNS lymphoma occurs in people with HIV with CD4 cell counts of less than 50, typically a focal brain lesion. And this is always associated with Epstein-Barr virus. So two EBV-associated conditions in people with HIV. Let's also mention briefly some dermatologic findings in people with HIV. On the left-hand side of the screen is prurigo nodularis. These are hyperpigmented nodular lesions that are sometimes deep and palpable. They'll sometimes become hyperpigmented, and they can sometimes be a little bit difficult to distinguish from Kaposi sarcoma. But what these reflect is areas of pruritus, scratching, where people have scratched and developed these nodular lesions. So you will find these lesions of prurigo nodularis limited to places where people can reach, basically where people can scratch. On the right-hand side of the screen is a typical picture of Kaposi sarcoma. This is a human herpes virus 8-associated condition. You're seeing these purplish plaques that can sometimes be in very cosmetically disfiguring parts of the body, such as the face. So quite a typical picture of the purplish plaques of Kaposi sarcoma. So now let's go to our second topic, which is other fungal infections. And here we're going to be talking about fungal infections other than cryptococcal meningitis, which we covered in a prior lecture. And we'll talk about fungal infections other than Candida, since we've spent a good amount of time on Candida already. And the four different fungal infections that we'll say a word about are non-cryptococcal sites of disease. We're going to talk about cutaneous cryptococcal infection and prostate abscess due to cryptococcus. We'll then talk about Tayloromyces, which is a geographically limited fungal infection. We'll talk briefly about histoplasmosis and show you typical morphology of histoplasmosis. And we'll also show you the typical morphology of coccidioidomycosis. So let's start off with cryptococcal prostate abscess. This is a patient that I saw during fellowship. So some years ago, I saw a man with advanced HIV. His CD4 count was only 40. He had a HIV RNA of 225,000. He was not on antiretroviral therapy. This man presented with 4 weeks of pain on defecation. And what you can see on the bottom left is a pelvic CT scan showing you a prostate abscess. When we aspirated the prostate abscess, the silver stain of the prostatic aspirate is in the middle, and you can see these organisms that take up the silver stain. And then on the right of the screen is hematoxylin and eosin, an H&E stain of the same prostatic aspirate. And what you're seeing is the fungal organisms, the yeast, with a capsule surrounding them. That's what the arrows are pointing to, is that capsule around the cryptococcus. Remember, the cryptococcus is an encapsulated yeast, and this type of histology is very, very typical of cryptococcus and should really nail the diagnosis of cryptococcal infection. Here's a second feared complication of cryptococcus, which is mucocutaneous cryptococcus. This is another patient. This is a series of images from the ID Images website that I mentioned during the live course. This is a man with advanced HIV. His CD4 count is less than 20. He also is not on antiretroviral therapy. He presented with fever, cough, and skin lesions. What you're seeing on the left-hand side of the screen are these large, angry-looking papules on the face. You also see papules in his mouth. And then on the right, you're seeing the papules are umbilicated, and this umbilication, kind of this indentation of the papules, is a tip-off for one of the ways that cryptococcus can appear when it presents with cutaneous disease. This person went on to have a skin biopsy. And again, on the left of the screen is a silver stain of the skin biopsy showing multiple organisms throughout the skin. And then on the right-hand side of the screen is a mucicarmine stain of the biopsy. All of those pink organisms are the cryptococcus. If you see a image in the exam of a mucicarmine stain, that is the typical stain that is used to pick up cryptococcus. So this is a person with cutaneous cryptococcus with the mucicarmine stain picking up the organisms. Another fungus that I want to highlight here is Tayloromyces marneffei. This is formerly known as Penicillium marneffei. This particular dimorphic fungus is endemic in Southeast Asia, East Asia, and South Asia. The map here shows you areas that are endemic as well as areas of the highest incidence. Advanced HIV is a risk factor for severe disease. On the right, you're seeing these typical skin lesions of Tayloromyces. These two can be centrally necrotic or umbilicated papules, very similar to what we showed you with Cryptococcus. But here, the tip-off in real life, as well as on the exam, is that the patient will be from Southeast Asia, East Asia, or South Asia. Tayloromyces can also cause pulmonary or GI involvement and can present with hepatosplenomegaly. So think about this when you have a patient from the right part of the world with advanced HIV. Here are some other images of Tayloromyces. On the left are those umbilicated papules, a cutaneous manifestation. In the middle is the pulmonary disease due to Tayloromyces. And on the right-hand part of the screen is a histology of the organisms. These are round to oval organisms. They're about 3 to 6 microns in diameter, so they're quite small. And what the arrow is showing you is a midline septum and a dividing yeast cell. If you see on the exam or in pathology, someone from the right part of the world, Southeast Asia, advanced HIV, where they show an organism with a midline septum and a dividing yeast cell, that is the typical histology of Tayloromyces. And so that thin septum that's shown here is going to be the tip-off. This is a series of images of HIV-associated skin conditions, some of which are endemic mycoses, and these can be quite difficult to distinguish unless you have the epidemiology in hand. On the left part of the screen is Tayloromyces, a third image of the umbilicated papules. Then we see Cryptococcus, the same case that I showed you before. Molluscum can also give you umbilicated papules, and that's shown in the picture on the screen, but Molluscum will not present with the systemic and pulmonary and other manifestations, systemic manifestations that you'll get with an endemic mycosis that's gone to the skin. And then finally, histoplasma can also give you papules. So Molluscum is a mimic, but when you have systemic symptoms, think about some of these dimorphic fungi that are shown here on the screen. Other fungal diseases that are covered elsewhere in the course are the ones shown here. So look for questions on the exam on patients with HIV and histoplasma. Here's an image of the narrow-based budding of histoplasma. These yeasts are quite small, 2 to 5 microns, and there's narrow-based budding is the tip-off for histoplasma. On the top right is the typical fit picture for blastomyces. These are larger. These are 10 to 15 microns, so quite a bit larger than histoplasma. But the tip-off here is the broad-based budding of blastomyces. The way you can remember is the alliteration of the broad-based budding of blastomyces. On the bottom left, you're seeing what's called a spherule of coccidioides. These are even larger. You see the endospores in the spherule, and that's a very, very typical picture of coccidioides. And then paracoccidioides is typically in South America, and this can give you on histology what's sometimes called a pilot wheel morphology. So these are the four different histologies to keep in mind as you're thinking about endemic fungi in people with HIV. Okay, let's go on to our next topic, which is gastrointestinal complications of HIV. And here we're going to really focus in on diarrheal diseases, as well as a few extra intestinal manifestations of some of the infections, the opportunistic infections that can cause diarrhea in people with HIV. So let's start off with CMV colitis, and we're going to go into a bit more detail on this in just a moment. But CMV colitis can present with bloody diarrhea, intestinal perforation in people with HIV who are very immunosuppressed. They typically have a CD4 count of less than 100. So think about CMV colitis in that clinical context. Bacterial causes of diarrhea in people with HIV can include Salmonella, Shigella, Campylobacter. Enteroaggregative E. coli can also cause diarrhea in people with HIV. Clostridioides difficile, C. diff, can cause diarrhea in people with HIV, even sometimes in the absence of antibiotics. Sexually transmitted infections can cause proctitis, typically in men who have sex with men. So things like lymphogranuloma venereum, gonorrhea, syphilis, all three of these can cause a proctitis and diarrhea in people with HIV. Mycobacterium avium complex, which we talked about in a prior lecture, can cause diarrhea, but it's limited to people who are very immunosuppressed. CD4 cell counts are typically below 50, and people present with diarrhea, but they also have fever, wasting, anorexia, and systemic symptoms. In terms of parasitic causes, Microsporidia and Cryptosporidia can cause diarrhea in people with HIV. They typically cause prolonged diarrhea in people who have CD4 cell counts of less than 100. They can also cause extraintestinal manifestations, manifestations outside of the gut in people with very, very low CD4 counts, CD4 counts less than 100. So for example, Microsporidia can cause biliary tract disease. Microsporidia can even cause sinus and pulmonary disease. Cryptosporidiosis can also cause biliary tract disease, but again, this is limited to people with CD4 counts less than 100. Another parasitic cause of diarrhea in people with HIV is Isospora, now recently renamed Cystoisospora. Cyclospora can cause diarrhea in people with HIV. Giardia and amebiasis are other parasitic causes of diarrhea in people with HIV. Cancer, such as Kaposi sarcoma, can cause gastrointestinal involvement, and lymphoma can also cause gastrointestinal involvement. So think about those possibilities in people with advanced HIV. And finally, don't forget medications, antiretroviral therapy in particular, especially protease inhibitors used to be a common cause of diarrhea in people with HIV. Antibiotics such as trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole can also cause diarrhea in people with HIV. So how does one go about evaluating diarrhea in a person with advanced HIV? If someone has acute diarrhea, do a stool culture and sensitivity, and also make sure to check for C. difficile, even if they haven't had antibiotics. If they have chronic diarrhea, do the workup for acute diarrhea, do the stool CNS, do the C. diff testing, but also add on a stool, ova, and parasites, add on special stains for Cryptosporidia, Microsporidia, Isospora, and Cyclospora, do a Giardia antigen, particularly if they have small bowel diarrhea, and if they have evidence of proctitis, don't forget to do sexually transmitted infection testing. In a person who presents with diarrhea, fever, and systemic symptoms, and if they have HIV and low CD4 cell counts, make sure to send an SFS bacilli or mycobacterial blood culture, and also consider doing a CMV DNA, and we'll come back to CMV momentarily. And finally, if the evaluation above is unrevealing, that's when you want to go rapidly to endoscopy to try to make a firm microbiologic diagnosis as to the cause of the diarrhea. Salmonella can cause recurrent infections in people with HIV, and Salmonella can cause bacteremia in people with HIV. In fact, back in the 90s, when I first started in this field, bacteremia and recurrent bacteremia was a very common cause of complications in people with HIV. Bacteremia due to Salmonella is more common in people who have low CD4 cell counts and more common in people with HIV than people without HIV. In fact, if you see bacteremia due to Salmonella and if a person has not had recent HIV testing, it's important to make sure to do that HIV testing. And unless people are treated with effective antiretroviral therapy, recurrent bacteremia is really quite common and can be quite problematic. So back again in the early 90s, before we had effective antiretroviral therapy, we used to see quite commonly recurrent bacteremia, which was really very, very difficult to manage. And then Shigella is an important topic in people with HIV as well as in people without HIV. I just wanted to highlight the growing rates of antibiotic resistance in Shigella. This is a health update from the CDC back in 2018 that really highlighted the issue of Shigella isolates that were testing susceptible to ciprofloxacin with an MIC of 0.12 to 1 microgram per mil. So testing susceptible, but in an intermediate range, but harboring resistance genes. And that led the CDC at the time to recommend antibiotics be reserved for people who are immunocompromised, people who have severe illness or in the outbreak setting. And they also reminded us to counsel patients to wait to have sex for 1 to 2 weeks after the diarrhea has resolved. So that's some of the antibiotic resistance in Shigella. But in recent years, in fact, in 2023, there's been an increase in what's now being called extensively drug-resistant shigellosis. About 5% of Shigella isolates in the United States now are what is called XDR, or extensively drug resistant. And what does that mean? That means resistance to azithromycin, ampicillin, ciprofloxacin, ceftriaxone, and trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole, all of the drugs that we typically think of as being active against Shigella. This has been reported in men who have sex with men and people experiencing homelessness and in international travelers, as well as in people with HIV. This graphic shows you the uptick in the isolates that are resistant to all these different antibiotics. Because of this extensive drug resistance, there are no current treatment recommendations in the United Kingdom. Oral pivmesylinum and fosfomycin have been used, as well as IV carbapenem and colistin in hospitalized patients. But really, we await a better guidance around treating this XDR Shigella, and we hope that that guidance will come as soon. And then the last topic before we conclude is cytomegalovirus. So CMV, here are some of the highlights that I want to draw your attention to. CMV is a cause of end organ disease in people with HIV who have CD4 cell counts of less than 50 and are not receiving antiretroviral therapy. So it's really a manifestation of severe immunosuppression. Some of the end organ diseases to keep your eye out for include retinitis. We're going to talk a bit about CMV retinitis, colitis, esophagitis. We talked earlier in the talk about odynophagia, retrosternal or mid-epigastric pain as a manifestation of CMV esophagitis. CMV can cause neurologic disease. And then CMV pneumonitis. And here I want to pause for a minute because CMV pneumonitis is actually quite rare in people with HIV. Unlike the stem cell transplant population, where CMV is a very, very common cause of pneumonitis, in people with HIV, even in people with advanced HIV, CMV very, very rarely causes pneumonitis. In fact, when you find CMV in a bronchoalveolar lavage, a BAL, it is quite frequently a bystander, and you should continue to look for alternative causes of pneumonitis in people with HIV. How does one prevent CMV disease in people with HIV? Really, the focus needs to be on antiretroviral therapy to maintain a CD4 cell count of over 100. That is by far the best way to prevent CMV disease in people with HIV is ART. In fact, valganciclovir prophylaxis is not recommended to prevent CMV disease. How does one diagnose HIV-related CMV disease? First, you do a serology. Disease is quite unlikely if the person is IgG seronegative. So make sure that you check a serology. And if the person is IgG seronegative, the manifestation is probably not CMV. Cytology is rarely useful. Biopsy of an area of end organ disease is quite helpful if there are many inclusions and substantial inflammation. And then PCR correlates with low CD4 cell count and has less than ideal sensitivity and specificity for clinical disease. So CMV retinitis is one of the most feared complications of advanced HIV, and back in the 80s and 90s was a terrible complication that we saw quite frequently. It presents with visual changes and decreased visual acuity. On fundoscopic exam, 2/3 of individuals will have unilateral disease, but 1/3 of individuals will have CMV in both eyes. What you're seeing in the right-hand part of the screen is the typical mustard and ketchup appearance of CMV retinitis. This really reflects necrosis of the retina. People with CMV retinitis typically have very little vitreal inflammation. PCR of the blood is about 70% sensitive, but it's fairly nonspecific. That is, it doesn't necessarily indicate if it's positive that someone has CMV retinitis. Vitreal taps for diagnosis with PCR are rarely necessary. If it's done, the tap is positive in about 80% of cases, but most of the time, this is clinical diagnosis made by ophthalmologic examination in the right clinical setting, in particular in a person with a CD4 count of less than 50. In terms of therapy for CMV retinitis, if a person has immediate sight-threatening lesions, you're going to start antiretroviral therapy, but you're also going to give systemic ganciclovir or valganciclovir. If you're giving valganciclovir, which is an oral drug, it's 900 milligrams by mouth twice a day for 14 to 21 days. The valganciclovir or ganciclovir should be given as an induction, but then daily for at least 3 to 6 months thereafter. In addition to systemic ganciclovir or valganciclovir, most of the time, if there's immediate sight-threatening disease, in fact, all of the time, if there's immediate sight-threatening lesions, you're going to want to have the ophthalmologist give intravitreal ganciclovir. It's usually given weekly over several weeks until the lesions are inactive. Ganciclovir implants used to be used. They are no longer manufactured, so that wouldn't be an answer because ganciclovir implants are no longer manufactured in the U.S. If there's CMV retinitis where the lesions are small and peripheral, then again, ART is the mainstay. Antiretroviral therapy is the mainstay. Oral valganciclovir is added for at least 3 to 6 months and after people have immune reconstitution, and then plus minus intravitreal ganciclovir. Let's now shift to CMV colitis for a moment. CMV colitis typically presents with fever, anorexia, abdominal pain, and diarrhea. CMV can cause intestinal perforation and intestinal hemorrhage, and a CT scan may show colonic thickening, but may even show a mass. So think about that in the right clinical setting. Diagnosis is usually with colonoscopy, with cytology or biopsy. CMV usually causes mucosal ulcerations. On biopsy, you'll see intranuclear and intracytoplasmic inclusions. And then immunohistochemistry is the mainstay of really seeing a CMV. PCR is nonspecific, and therapy is usually with ganciclovir or valganciclovir with foscarnet as an alternative. Here are some of the typical pictures of CMV colitis. On the left-hand side of the screen are the mucosal ulcerations that I mentioned. In the middle is a biopsy of one of those mucosal ulcerations, showing you those intranuclear inclusions that are the tip-off for CMV. And then on the right-hand side is someone who's suffered intestinal perforation from CMV colitis. CMV neurologic disease includes encephalitis. It can also manifest as ventriculoencephalitis, where people present with focal neurologic signs. If untreated and unrecognized, this can rapidly progress, sometimes to death. Imaging on MRI or CT may show you periventricular enhancement. And then a third complication of CMV neurologic disease is polyradiculomyelopathy or transverse myelitis. Patients with advanced HEV can present with radicular back pain. They can have urinary retention and bilateral leg weakness. It can present also as a spastic myelopathy with sacral or saddle paresthesias or anesthesias. The CSF is one of the tip-offs. Unlike other viral causes of transverse myelitis, other viral causes of polyradiculomyelopathy, in CMV, you get a neutrophilic pleocytosis with cell counts between 100 to 200, which are predominantly neutrophils. People can have a low glucose in their CSF and an elevated protein. So remember that as one of the typical ways that CSF formulas can give you a clue as to CMV neurologic disease. So with that, I want to thank you for your attention. Looking forward to seeing you in person at the course, and looking forward to your feedback. Enjoy talking with you today.